My name is Sarah Stevens, and I'm here with Nell Green Nyland, and we are both members of Students for Economic and Environmental Justice. One of the principal reasons that SEEJ organizes the symposium is to raise awareness of environmental justice issues. Environmental justice is the right we all have to live, work, play, and pray in a safe, clean, and healthy environment. It is a movement that weaves together strands of civil rights, public health, environmentalism, and community development. SEEJ chose to focus this year's symposium on struggles in rural America because rural communities often have the most extreme needs and receive the least amount of resources. We are certainly situated in an urban environment, but Bolt sits just 50 miles from one of the poorest regions in the United States, the San Joaquin Valley, where environmental justice challenges abound. We hope that this symposium stimulates more engagement in rural issues and leads to a deeper institutional commitment and individual career-long commitments in rural areas. There are two remaining events we hope you'll attend in addition to this one. Tomorrow, there will be a lunchtime panel discussion at the YWCA titled Not a Drop to Drink, The Struggle for Potable Water in the Central Valley. And on Friday, environmental justice leaders will gather for a discussion titled A Call to Action in Rural America. Before we begin, we'd like to give a huge thank you to our sponsors, the Thelton Henderson Center for Social Justice, the Graduate Assembly, the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment, Ecology Law Quarterly, the California Water Law Symposium, Student Services, and Shute Wahali and Weinberger. Next, now we'll introduce our moderator.
Hi, I'd like to introduce Robert Infelice. He's a lecturer here at Bolt, and I think he's been doing that since 1994. He teaches a variety of environmental law classes, and I've taken several of them from him. Anyway, Bob Infelice.
Thank you, Nell. Thank you very much, everybody, and welcome. So just as a preview, we're going to go probably until about 1:50 today. I'm going to try to start taking questions around 1:40. I may have to bolt because I have class at 2:00, but our panelists have told me that they would be happy to hang around for a little while and answer other questions. California's Central Valley has been described as a land of contradictions. On one hand, it contains some of the most productive agricultural land in the world. And as a result of that, the Central Valley has made many people quite wealthy. On the other hand, the vast majority of the people who do the backbreaking work to create that wealth live below the poverty line. There are approximately 4 million residents of the Central Valley. A study conducted by the Center for Regional Change at UC Davis found that nearly a third of Central Valley residents face high degrees of environmental risk, principally from air and water pollution, and high degrees of social vulnerability in the form of poverty, inadequate educational opportunities, and low literacy rates. The study also found that there are many more environmental hazards facing residents of the Central Valley than are acknowledged by the state and federal agencies who are charged with protecting residents from those pollutants. Kettleman City. Kettleman City is a microcosm of the entire valley. The poverty rate among the 1,500 residents is staggering in comparison to the rest of the state. Yet, it's surrounded by, on three sides, by exceedingly productive agricultural land, and on the fourth side by Kettleman Hills, one of the largest landfills in the country taking hazardous materials. That facility is operated by Waste Management. We're joined today, by the way, by one of the community representatives from Waste Management in the audience. So welcome. The facility is not the only hazardous waste facility in the Central Valley. There are two others, one located in Button Willow and the other in Westmoreland. There are, of course, many narratives that could describe any community, and the same applies to Kettleman City. One narrative notes Kettleman City's good fortune of being the home of a landfill that is carefully regulated, the source of many jobs in the community, and an important part of the community. Another narrative describes a community in peril. imperil from the synergistic effects of big agriculture and a huge hazardous waste dump site right on the border. Agricultural production brings with it exposures to countless chemicals and fertilizers, pesticides, and herbicides. And Kettleman Hills, by definition almost, carries with it the potential for exposures to a veritable witch's brew of toxic chemicals. This narrative is punctuated by a host of adverse health impacts, one of which is birth defects that are becoming increasingly common. No matter which narrative best describes Kettleman Hills, which best describes reality, one cannot help but wonder why it is that the three biggest landfills in California happen to be located in poor rural communities. Let's watch a brief video about Kettleman Hills before we turn it over to our panelists. And I'm going to let somebody else press the right buttons.
You're just here, you're just in Kettleman. These women have stated that they're not directly saying that this facility is causing those birth defects, but they would like to know what is and call for an investigation.
There's been a lot of people that have had kids in and out of this facility, and not one of them has had any type of, you know, any problems, matter of fact.
We're very proud of what we do here, and we've always put safety and protecting human health and the environment first and foremost.
At the end of the day, we know that there is nothing for us to hide. Waste management is a highly regulated facility. Waste management has been operating for 30 years.
Coming together, let's get some answers. It's not an us versus them. It's a let's get the full picture of what's happening here.
We're in agricultural land where they use pesticides on a regular basis.
So pesticides is a factor?
I live one street away from a field.
All the chemicals, the smell in the summer, the things we're breathing.
We don't have hospitals.
It's not going to affect
we
like
don't
me
have
now,
clinic.
But in the future it is.
We don't have nothing.
To my children, yeah.
And it's bad. And it's bad.
The water here is not drinkable.
The water is bad.
It's contaminated with arsenic.
That's why I always have to like buy the water, a gallon of water every day.
It's wrong to let in more polluting industries when we already face so many different things.
When do we want it?
Now!
When do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Now!
And we don't want anything. Just we want explain or they tell me what is going on with the babies. What happened?
We've offered numerous times for the residents to come to waste management and take a tour and actually see what goes on. you know, we've tried and struggled, and in spite of all this,
I don't buy
it. They don't care. They don't agree.
They're so good for the community.
Justicia!
¿Cuándo?
Ahora!
¿Qué queremos?
Justicia!
¿Cuándo?
Ahora!
We're just asking simple questions. We're just asking simple things.
Okay, what were the ages of the mothers? How long have you lived in Kettleman? Where did you live before? Have you worked in the fields?
We're telling the truth. We ain't liars.
I have an open heart, and I'm speaking what I feel that's coming out of my heart. And this is the truth.
It makes me angry because I don't know how it feels.
All together, are these things harming us? And if so, how are they harming us? What can we do? And who's going to protect us?
Yes, these parents are probably afraid. Yes, they're scared because have received information. They have received this ugly picture about waste management.
The people are tired of being dumped on.
We come over here for a better life. Not for me, for my daughters, for my sons. That's only what I wanted. And I'll tell the people, please help us this little town. This little town, we need really a lot of service.
I don't hope they never stay in my shoes or stand in my shoes for a minute because it's hard.
Yes, we do feel bad for these mothers. We do feel bad for these babies.
Her head was not fully developed.
We do feel bad for any resident that is sick of any kind.
She was going to die on my own. And she did. Seeing a child, a small baby. And it reminds me of my baby, not having her. Every time I see her ultrasounds, I remember her, her kicks on my stomach. Every time I see a baby, it reminds me of mine. But now I'm afraid to have another one, because I'm afraid for the next one to come out the same.
Waste Management is trying to do everything in their power and their hands to be able to get these parents the answers that they want.
I don't want them to ignore us. I want them to do something about it.
We want a simple victory for these families concerned dealing with such an emotional and difficult situation.
We're just asking them not to expand.
We feel like what we're already facing is affecting our health.
And we demand response. And we want to know what's going on. Not only with my baby, with all the babies that already passed away. That's what I need.
That's what I want. I want more answers. I want my questions to be answered, and I want action. That's what I want.
Obviously, it's a complex issue and heartbreaking at the same time. Let me introduce our panelists. They're deeply, both of them, all three of them actually, because we're joined by a surprise guest today, are all committed to trying to better the lives of the residents of the Central Valley. Let me begin with Ingrid Brostrom. Ms. Brostrom is a graduate of Hastings College of the Law. Ingrid originally joined the Center for Race, Poverty, and the Environment as an Equal Justice Works Fellow. Her fellowship project, Don't Waste the Valley, focused on waste issues facing the Central Valley, ranging from hazardous waste facility expansion, as was just focused on, to biosolid application on agricultural lands. Ingrid is now a staff attorney with the center and is actively litigating on behalf of Central Valley residents. Marisela Maris Alatorre lives in Kettleman City. She received her BA in linguistics from Fresno State University in 2000 and has since worked as a teacher, an employment counselor, and a parenting instructor. She's been active in the environmental justice community for the past 22 years. In fact, her activism seems to run in her family. Her parents were the co-founders of the group People for Clean Air and Water in Kettleman City, which defeated a proposal to build what would have been California's first toxic waste incinerator and is now campaigning to prevent an expansion of Kettleman Hills. Marisela is the spokesperson for that group. She's joined today by her son, Miguel, who is a member of the youth group Kids Protecting Our Planet, focusing on environmental justice in the community. I asked Miguel before we started if he was eventually going to be a law student here. The kid said he thought about it, but he smartened up and now wants to be a teacher. Marisela advises the youth group that Miguel is involved in. Her principal role is as a community organizer for Green Action for Health and Environmental Justice. Marisela is also a member of the Central Valley Air Quality Coalition and San Joaquin Valley Cumulative Health Impacts Project Steering Committee. She's also on the advisory committee for the Tulare Lake Basin Disadvantaged Community Water Study and is on the board of directors of the Kettleman City Foundation. Trucks filled with PCBs, benzene, and asbestos continue to pass within 3 miles of Marisela's home on their way to Kettleman Hills. So those are our panelists today. Let's begin with Marisela. If we were to visit Kettleman City, what would we see today? What does the community look like? What services are available?
Well, I think you saw from the, good afternoon, Marisela. And I think you saw from the video a very good picture of Kettleman City. It's a very small town in a rural area of Kings County. And we don't have any sidewalks. We don't have any street lights, any stop signs in town. It's a very, very small, poor town. The majority works in agriculture. They're farm workers. My parents moved there from Los Angeles in the 70s because they wanted they were farm workers and they wanted a safe environment to raise me, and it's pretty much stayed the same since we got there in 77. And it's the kind of town where everybody knows each other, where if my kid does something bad across town, within 20 minutes, three different people have called me and let me know what he did and how he did it. It's the kind of town where your hand gets tired from going down the street and waving at so many people that everybody knows you. And they know embarrassing stories about you when you were little. I think despite the poverty, and there is a real lack of education in town as well, at last count, I think it was only 17% of the residents have a high school diploma. Despite the poverty, I think it's a town where everybody is hardworking and has the same dream as any other small town in the U.S., where you want to have your family and you want to be safe and you want to have a home where you could raise that family and be safe.
What are the major employers, for those that do have jobs, where are they employed?
Number one would be agriculture. There's also where the junction between Highway 41 and Interstate 5. So we have various fast food and gas stations. A lot of people are employed there. We're fortunate, when people think about Kettleman City and the economic issues there, we're fortunate in that whoever wants to work has a job. They're not high-paying jobs, and they're not jobs that you need an education to do, but there is work there, and people are hardworking.
What percentage of the residents would work at Kettleman Hills?
Right now, there is, to my knowledge, only one person living in town, who recently moved into town and happens to be the spokesperson, the community spokesperson for the plant, who actually lives in town. Everybody else has left. They went other places. And I know several years ago there was a congressman looking into what kind of benefits towns like Kettleman City have that have a landfill in town. And at that time, and this was several years back, there was only 6 people who actually lived in town who worked at the plant. Everybody else comes from somewhere else.
What healthcare services are available in the community for the residents?
Currently, there's a clinic that operates 3 days a week. It's very limited. If you go there and you're ill and you need a prescription, you still have to drive 40 miles out of town to the closest pharmacy.
Tell us a little bit about the school system in town.
It's a very small school system. It goes K through 8. There's no high school there. For high school, students have to drive. They're bused 17 miles away to Avenel, to the nearest high school. And it's bleak, like a lot of places in the Central Valley. I was just talking to my son, and we determined that out of his 8th grade class, it had about 27 students. 25% of them are parents now. So their odds of going on to higher education are very limited.
Does waste management contribute at all to the community?
It contributes in that there's donations made to the school and whatnot, and it's like any business that needs people to that needs the support of the people. They contribute stuff.
So, for those of you that have had environmental law and policy and the environmental justice class, you know that the siting decisions are one of the most controversial and important aspects of environmental justice, and much has been written about it. They are complicated decisions, to say the least. Let me turn to Ingrid. So the 3 largest landfills just happen to be in the Central Valley. How did that happen? What accounts for that?
Well, the traditional answer that people like to throw out is that obviously that's where the cheapest land is. But that's just the beginning of the equation, because oftentimes facilities will try to locate in places that are politically favorable. In the Central Valley, you have politics that are very industry friendly. As well as looking for places where they would expect less opposition. And, you know, these tend to be the prevailing knowledge is you go to places where there's high disempowerment that can be transient populations, that can be lower educated populations, poor people. And in fact, in 1984, the California Waste Board, they commissioned a study looking at what types of areas would be the least likely to oppose facilities such as hazardous waste incinerators and other undesirable facilities. And the study found that the places that were least likely to oppose were Catholic, rural, resource extractive, low income, and transient. And so when you take that language and you translate it, what they were really saying is Latino, farmworking Latino communities. And in fact, when we look at the 3 facilities, and in fact, one is in the Imperial Valley, which is not exactly Central Valley, but they are all 3 low income, farmworking rural communities, populated largely by Hispanic farmworkers. So it's not an accident. There's a lot of politics involved, and so, I mean, so we don't think there's any kind of accident that these facilities are located where they're at. And I just want to point out one thing. When we're talking about, you know, the 2 narratives, the dichotomy is not, you know, whether this facility is good for the community or it's bad for the community. This facility is bad for the community. You know, as Maricela just said, it offers no jobs, very little of the tax income that they contribute to Kings County goes back into Kettleman City. It goes to other areas. There's other richer areas in the county that receive a lot of the tax benefit. So the real question is yes, there is a benefit. The benefit is to you and I, people that don't live in these areas, we have some place to put our hazardous waste. But I think that's the dichotomy that we have to think about is, you know, is it you know, is it fair that a very small subsection of our population has to bear the entire brunt of basically things that benefit other people very far removed from any of it? So I think that's the dichotomy that we're looking at here.
Would you agree, though, that the transfer of the tax money to other communities is a problem with the Board of Supervisors, not necessarily with the operator of Kettleman Hills?
Yes. And you know, when we talk about chem waste, Kings County, which is the decision-making board, bears a huge amount of responsibility. They are the board that you know ultimately has the say as whether or not this is a prudent land use decision. And we look at the historical decisions that have made about Kettleman City, and we see not just chem waste, but we see a lot of other land use decisions that have been made by Kings County. And again, you come back to the same principle of that board. And a lot of the boards in the Central Valley are not representatives of the communities they represent. You know, in terms of you're not seeing Latino farm workers having a voice on these boards predominantly. They tend to come from more affluent families. They tend to be older. They tend to be white and male. And so it's very hard to have your interests really represented when you're not represented on the board.
And am I correct that the Board of Supervisors just unanimously approved an expansion of Kettleman Hills?
Yes, that is true, and it is being litigated.
Okay, let me ask one other question. What other factors do you see going into these siting decisions? Is it just a question of picking out the communities with the least opposition likely to arise?
I'm not saying that cheap land is not part of the equation, but it's only the first part of the equation. You do have lower land costs in the Central Valley, and you do have space in the Central Valley. And you know, when you talk about rural versus urban areas, it's very easy to kind of transplant things from urban areas to a place where you just don't see a lot of people. And so you hear that as being a common argument as well, is, well, there's less people there, so it's not impacting as many. And that's really gets at the heart of especially rural environmental justice, is taking into consideration that that's not the correct value system that we should be judging a project by.
Let me come back to you, Ingrid, on the litigation that's ongoing. And turn to Marisela for a moment. Clearly, the cost of land and the location are important in these siting decisions. But what's your take on how it turned out that the three biggest landfills happened to be within driving distance in the Central Valley?
I think that when you choose something that's going to be controversial, a controversial project, and you look for communities with specifically the demographics that exist in Kettleman City, then that is a form of racism. It's an ugly word, and it's not something that people want to hear a lot of times. But when you're specifically targeting those kind of communities, that is a case of environmental racism. A lot of the times, and it's what Ingrid said, that it's the politics and it's the cheap land. A lot of the times they'll throw out that it's geology. The geology of the land was perfect. The wind never blows from the plant to the town is the, what they say. But more than the geology, more than anything else, I think that it's politics, and it's the politics of racism.
And let's talk about the politics a bit. I know you've been active before the Board of Supervisors. Tell me what's going on in that regard. Are the groups you're involved with trying to lobby the Board of Supervisors on this issue, for example, of expansion of Kettleman Hills?
And definitely. We're in the situation where we live in a town that's unincorporated. So there's no form of government in town. There's no city council. There's no mayor. The closest thing that we get to any kind of governance in town is the Kettleman City Community Services District, which runs our water. So when we see that this plant that generates a huge, huge amount of the Kings County budget through the tax revenue that's generated there, and it goes straight to the county seat, which is 40 miles away and is we're 97% Latino in Kettleman City. The county seat, Hanford, is 51% Caucasian. So when you see the difference in that they get the economic benefit, but we have to bear the brunt of it by living next to it. That definitely seems unjust.
What's going on in that regard? Are you making any progress in organizing the community to lobby, for example, the Board of Supervisors?
Oh, definitely. We've gone before the Board of Supervisors, but it's been a very difficult process. When we had the first hearing for in December 2010, we had the first hearing before the Board of Supervisors to hear about the expansion project. We were told that if you spoke Spanish, you got 2.5 minutes to testify. If you spoke English, you got 5 minutes to testify. And the company trucked in workers from their different plants all over the valley, from very far away, people that did not live in Kettleman City, that had no other interest other than, you know, their job. And they were there, and they were, you know, shouting us down and shouting insults. And when we're told that we don't get equal time to speak, it's just, who does that? Where is that okay? I know my dad immigrated from Mexico, and he became a citizen in 2008, and he's really proud of it. But he understands English, but he speaks Spanish better. So when he went up and he asked for equal time to speak, this 60-year-old man was dragged out by 8 police officers. I just don't see the justice in that. I don't see how you can say that this is a fair process when you have people that are not given the basic liberties of equal time to speak.
Let me go back to Ingrid. You mentioned the litigation. Can you talk to us about that? Who's the target? What are the claims?
Sure. We represent, or my organization represents, El Pueblo, Maricela's group, and we brought litigation against the county for approving the facility based on two types of claims. One is environmental CEQA claims, all of the impacts before approving the project, but also on civil rights grounds, which really centered on kind of a long-standing history and pattern of citing, kind of very polluting industry around Kettleman City and returning very little of the tax benefit to them. So Kettleman City is has the highest percentage of Latinos in the county. And that also is the community that has the most polluting industry. And so the claim is that it was a have the hazardous waste dump expanded was just another instance where the county was targeting its Latino residents to bear the largest brunt of the pollution and get least of the benefit. Our environmental claims really, centered on the birth defects. The birth defects started emerging right during the EIR process, where they were looking at all of the potential impacts of expanding the project and mitigating those impacts. And despite repeatedly being informed about the birth defects, about concerns that PCBs, which are disposed at Kettleman City, it's one of only 8 facilities in the entire U.S. that can take PCBs, are actually documented to cause cleft palate, which was the best birth defect that we were seeing in Kettleman City. Despite having all of this information and the studies, they refused to look at whether or not the existing facility contributed to the birth defect cluster, or whether expanding more chemicals into the city limits would exacerbate the already existing cluster regardless of its cause. So, we asserted that they needed to at least look at this issue, and they declined to do so.
Who are the targets of this action? What court is it pending in? And can you just give us a little brief primer on CEQA and EIRs and how the knowledge of the birth defects plays into that?
Sure. So we brought the case against Kings County in Kings County Superior Court. We lost all claims there, and the case is now on appeal in Fresno. So we've done all the briefing, and now we're just awaiting an oral argument and a decision. So a little background on CEQA is it's basically an environmental planning process whereby the county needs to look at all of the potential impacts of its decision as well as mitigate to the extent feasible any of the negative implications of its actions. So the claim really centers on basically inadequate disclosure of possible impacts or even just a refusal to even look at those impacts.
So the claim then is that the Board of Supervisors did not take an adequate look at the birth defects in the community. Just let me give you two sentences on this. So the National Environmental Policy Act is the federal equivalent to CEQA, and California then has its California Environmental Quality Act. One of the major differences between those two acts is that under CEQA, the sponsor of the project is bound to mitigate the impacts. Under NEPA, that's not true. So I'm assuming that's an important part of the lawsuit here. Okay, let's talk about the most difficult issue, the health impacts caused by the by Kettleman Hills as opposed to agriculture surrounding the town. And this is a difficult issue. Why? Because so far, the state and federal agencies that have sponsored studies have yet to find any link between Kettleman Hills and the birth defects and other health issues confronting the community. Marisela, what are they missing?
Well, when they started the study, and in the first place, it wasn't an easy process to get them to even start the study or acknowledge that these children existed. We would go to meetings and show them pictures of the children, and they would tell us, oh, that's a picture of the same child over and over again, or you got that picture from the internet, or all Mexican babies look alike. So it was difficult to get them to acknowledge it in the first place. And when they first acknowledged it and they did the preliminary study, they tried to blame the mothers for having children like this. One of the things, and I know that you heard, and this is the nature of Kettleman City, I know you heard the voice of Tony Sanchez, who formerly worked at the plant. He is related to us by marriage, and that's his cousin. And he no longer works at the plant. I don't know why. He won't tell us why, but he doesn't work there anymore. I know that you saw the first baby on there, Emmanuel Alatorre, who is also our cousin. And I'm sorry, it's not like we inbreed in Kettleman City. That's been suggested as well. It's just that it's a small town and everyone's related. And when they initially did the study, they tried to blame these mothers. They said, oh, these are older mothers. They did drugs. They didn't have any prenatal care. They had diabetes. Well, it just so happens that in the middle of the birth defect, when most of these children were born, I had a surprise pregnancy. My children are 14 years apart. My husband and I were very surprised and pleased to have a daughter in 2008. And we know how it happens. We just, I wasn't aware that I was pregnant until 6 months in. So I had no prenatal care. I was an older mother. I was 36, and that's pretty old in Kettleman City to have a child. And no prenatal care whatsoever, wasn't aware, had a drink at a wedding, just once. And my daughter was born fine, and we're blessed, she's perfect. But 10 days later, our cousin Emmanuel was born, and he had cleft palate, and he had other disabilities. So his mother, my son's cousin, was in her 20s, evangelical Christian, very clean living, knew she was pregnant right away, went to the doctor every month, and she still had a child with cleft palate. We don't know how that happened or why that happened. We know that there was a study done, and we knew at the beginning that the results might be inconclusive, but we were also hopeful that it would be a thorough study, and I'm here to tell you that it wasn't. And I know that for a fact because, again, everybody in Kettleman City knows each other. We know these mothers. And the study consisted of an 18-page survey. Not once did they do any biomonitoring. They didn't test their skin. They didn't test their hair. They didn't do any blood sampling, urine sampling. I think that the nature of the study was more to absolve certain entities as opposed to really finding what had affected these children. And I think that until there is a thorough study where they actually want to know what's in our bodies, if you want to know what's in a person's body, you test their body. then we can't say that it was a conclusive study, and we don't know. We don't know if it was the plant. We don't know if it was, you know, the thousands of trucks going through the town emitting diesel emissions. We don't know if it was pesticides. We don't know if it was the sewage sludge that they're carting in from Los Angeles. We also have a history as an oil drilling town. Our streets are named Standard Oil, General Petroleum, and it so happens that we have contaminated water. We drink well water that's contaminated with benzene and arsenic, and the benzene is a leftover from the drilling days, and it is a carcinogen and it causes birth defects. We don't know what out of these things it was. We don't know if it was, you know, a synergistic effect between all these different sources of contamination. What I know as a resident and someone that's concerned for my health and the health of my family is that since we don't know, it's not logical, it's not ethical, and it's not moral to add to that mix at this time.
Are you working with your state legislators and congressmen to try to get to the point of having what you would believe to be a more comprehensive study done?
We're definitely working, and we're still pushing for a more comprehensive study. It's the least that the mothers deserve.
Ingrid, let me turn to you. What is the center doing to try to get to this pivotal moment of being able to prove causation between the exposures in the community and the birth defects that you're seeing?
Well, I mean, first off, I would also note that the reports didn't find that there was not a link. They just were unable to determine that there was a link. So it's not just semantics. You know, oftentimes when you're dealing with health issues, either cancer or birth defects, it is extremely difficult to find a causal link. And this was acknowledged, you know, before the studies even embarked, that it was highly unlikely that a definite link would be established. But I don't think that in any way means that there's not a link, or that even the study suggests that there is not a link. The other thing that I would add about the health study is that it was done after the majority of the birth defects occurred. Many of the birth defects happened within an 18-month period, and that may have been due to a discrete event that happened, whether it be from chem waste or otherwise. We just
do you have a theory on that it might have been a discrete event?
Personal one.
Can you share it with us without?
I mean, that's the thing is these things are just so unknowable. In my mind, I always think that it's plausible that there was an accidental spill or some kind of accident that occurred. But will I ever be able to prove that? Will anybody ever be able to prove that? It would be very difficult. Very difficult to do. And so we're kind of stuck, you know, in this world where scientific, you know, certainty is really necessary to, you know, in our decision-making process, in our politics, in our political process, but it is very hard to establish that. And so we're kind of stuck in this this place where I don't know that we'd ever be able to with certainty say exactly what the birth defects are caused by. Yet, you know, here I sit, here Maricela sits, and asking that we don't need, or saying that we don't need to have absolute certainty. We know that there is a lot of pollution in this community that is, you know, recognized by all agencies. And so we use the precautionary principle. We know that pollution is not good for people. We know that this is a community that's in crisis. And we believe very strongly that it is inappropriate to add to the pollution burden, even without the scientific certainty, you know, that that some of the agencies, you know, are looking for.
Well, I want to open it up to the members of the audience for your questions and comments at this time. Yes.
The Federal Civil Rights Act is not doing much good, except for, you know, we do have an administrative civil rights complaint in with the EPA that has been pending for over 16 years. And we also are in litigation about that. And the claim in that one is precisely what we talked about first, which is all of the hazardous waste dumps in California are located in very similar communities. And how is this happening? You know, how is EPA has a large permitting responsibility for these facilities as well as other state agencies. And so the complaint names a number of state agencies and the EPA. So that lawsuit is still pending. In terms of litigation, we are pursuing a state civil rights cause of action that does allow us to get into court. The federal civil rights action does not have a private citizen suit provision, so we are unable to use it.
Yes.
I was wondering, I know many of us in the audience are interested in the use. I understand it's a relatively that, and also does it make it tough in the context of this litigation?
Well, I mean, our title, we have a new Title VI complaint for the expansion as well. But our Title VI complaint that's currently pending in front of the EPA is actually about the initial siting. And, you know, Title VI, for those of you who do not know, is basically prohibits the use of federal funds used for discriminatory practices. So in this case, we allege that Kings County has federal funds for our state claim, has state funds coming in, and that they are used in a discriminatory manner. The problems with Title VI, other than you can't go to court, is that you're stuck in an administrative process, and the administrative agencies, though they're required to act within 1 year, they oftentimes don't, whether it's the resources or the political will. Often we see these languishing within agencies for a very long time. In our case, it's been
The initial complaint was filed in 1994. My son was born in 94, and he's going to be an adult this year. So that's the nature of those.
Yeah,
and
it takes
time. The failure
to
act does not trigger your ability to go to federal court.
The failure to act does. So there is a litigation right now for the failure to act. There's been some recent case law mandating that the EPA take action on these. So,
and is that pending in D.C. or here in the Eastern District?
I'm not in charge of that case.
That should be in D.C., I would think, but I'm not sure. Any other questions? Yes, thank you.
Hola. Well, as was mentioned, my parents became involved in the 80s when there was what would have been California's first toxic waste incinerator proposed, and I went into the fight when I was in high school and was kind of a weekend warrior during college. I went back to Kittleman City to raise my family, and my son ended up involved in the struggle as well, and he's lived that since he was born. When my daughter was born, some people said, oh, yay, another generation, since she's 14 years apart, is it another generation to fight for environmental justice in Kittleman City? And my first thought was, why should she have to fight? Why do I have to give another child to the movement? And the difficulty is that things that make common sense outside of Kings County don't, there's no logic to it. It's blatantly racist. We are in a position where we're up against a company continuously that has so many more resources to buy people's hearts and loyalties that all we could do is tell them the truth. And sometimes, you know, when people are living in poverty and there's social vulnerability, if you give them a backpack, if you give them a T-shirt, if you give them a cap, you're going to buy them for that day, because that's the nature of human beings, I guess.
It's difficult because we have a board of supervisors that, again, is not representative of the community. We did go through a local assessment committee process for the expansion project, which is a committee where they have to sit people that are representative of the community that get a say in what benefits we should have in exchange for having to have this project in town. And out of this whole committee, this eight-member committee, they couldn't find one single Latino from Kettleman City to sit on the committee. They sat our one African-American citizen resident. That was who happens to be a notorious Kenway supporter. That's the only one that they could find to sit on this committee. And when I went to my first committee and I said, you know, this isn't fair. The next thing that I know, I got a call on my cell phone, my personal cell phone, from our supervisor that represents us. And he said, how would you like to be arrested the next time you go to an LAC meeting? I said, I don't think I'd like it, but I'd like to see you try. Because I haven't done anything. I said, go ahead and arrest a breastfeeding mother. That'd be great for you guys. You know, crazy things like that, where people can call and threaten you like that continuously. This is the nature of it, is that you can have a child going to school, and because the teachers are so happy to be getting, you know, whatever bone they'll throw to them. I remember we were at a rally one time and we were shouting, you know, si se puede, si se puede. Well, the next day the coach made my son run extra laps and ran behind him clapping, I thought si se puede, Miguel, I thought si se puede. and this can happen there. This is what happens there, and it's very difficult, and it is a very big burden to bear. And, you know, gosh, I'd like to stay home and read a book or watch TV, but it's not like I want to spend my life in all these meetings and hearings, but I just get so darn angry. If it's all on the up and up and everything's great, and maybe it is the best thing since sliced bread, but why all the underhandedness? If it wasn't for that, I could retire a happy person and you know, be a nice, calm, quiet citizen. But it's all the underhandedness that gets to me.
Let's ask Miguel's perspective on this as a kid that's basically lived your whole life with this struggle.
Well, just like my mom said, like before, Kettleman is poor. We don't have that great of an education system. So when it comes to the youth in Kettleman, you either, you know, don't do nothing with your life and work in the fields, or you become a gangbanger, because we have gang problems in Kettleman, as well as all the environmental and economic problems. We have gang violence in Kettleman City. And I was always ridiculed for sticking to the books and, you know, showing up to all these meetings and showing up to hearings and wearing the, you know, environmental t-shirts, stuff like that. I was always ridiculed for having a voice in my own community, and I thought, well, I need to get out of here as fast as possible. But it's hard with the way the economics are set up. Like, my school is about a 30-minute drive from Kettleman every single day that my mom drives me. Every single day.
Yeah, we ended up going out of district just because, well, for one, again, you know, it's not a lot of educational opportunities at our local high school. But for another, because it is so difficult when, it's difficult for me as an adult sometimes to keep my temper when we're ridiculed and we're told, you know, you're wrong, you don't know science. It's even more difficult for these kids that have grown up in the movement as well. And so I ended up sending him out of district for high school, which was, you know, a great thing for him anyway. It was a bonus. But it's hard. It's not, I don't think anyone grows up and says, you know, I want to be a pariah in my county and have people say, oh, you know, you're a tree hugger. I've never hugged a tree. I've never hugged a Delta smelt. I'm just concerned about my environment and my health and where my family is living. And it's difficult that people don't understand that that's what our struggle is about.
Well, I hope this has given you some food for thought and perspectives on an issue that is troubling beyond belief. I think our panelists are willing to stick around for a little while to answer questions, any other questions that you have. Let's join me in thanking them for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.